happy to present to you Dan Halperin, who is going to talk about using Apache Beam for batch streaming and everything in between. Please welcome Dan.
That is way too early applause. Thank you. All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Dan. So I am a committer and PMC member on Apache Beam. I'm also a software engineer at Google, where I've worked for 2 years on Beam and its predecessors. And by popular request, you even got my Twitter handle right here. So the Apache Beam project is an open source project that is about data processing, right? And it's really a collection of open source data processing APIs. The key things that Beam allows is it expresses data parallel batch and stream pipeline algorithms with one unified API. And in those APIs, we enable users to clearly separate their data processing logic from the runtime requirements of those pipelines. Beam pipelines can be executed in many different runtime environments, and Beam integrates well with the larger data processing ecosystem, both Apache, where it really got its start, and throughout. And today's a very special day. I would like to announce today, to be the first one to tell you today, that Apache press release announced we have release version 2.0 of Apache Beam, which is actually the first stable release of Beam under the Apache brand. There was a prior 1.0 version of the technology that came before Beam, pre-incubation. And so, you know, we're really excited that we have, you know, in the past 15 months, done a huge amount of work. The Beam community has done a huge amount of work to take sort of a fairly chaotic code base, turn it into something that's really truly portable, truly engine agnostic, truly ready for use. So, you know, one thing to take away is Beam is ready and let's go. Now there's lots of Beam at this talk, at this conference. In fact, I'm giving a talk, and in fact the next 3 talks, I believe all in this room, will be on Beam. And so we have speakers here and speakers there and speakers everywhere. On top of that, you know, maybe you want to see all 4 talks, maybe you don't. They're all going to be great, but I understand it's hard to stay in the same room for 6 hours. So there's also going to be, you know, some more collaborative peer-to-peer fun environments. So we're having a Birds of Feather session tonight. We're also going to have all day tomorrow, we're going to be around in the collaboration area on the second floor to do sort of hacking and hanging out and discussing and having fun as long as people show up. So there are lots of talk, lots of opportunities to engage. But in this talk, I'm going to talk about Apache Beam, give you an introduction and an update on where we are. So if you remember nothing else from this talk, what I want you to take away is that Apache Beam is 3 things. It's a unified programming model. It's designed to provide efficient and portable data processing pipelines. And to start, I'll give you a very quick, you know, one quick summary of the Beam model is that it enables users to ask the right questions. So they want to know what results are they interested in calculating. They also want to know where in time those results should be computed. When in sort of human time, in processing time, are those results materialized? When are they available for use? And as sort of the difference between processing time and event time is real, how do you update those results as things converge? And I'll explain all of this in better throughout the talk. But the important thing is that these types of questions enable us to do lots of interesting scenarios. So of course, I have some big collection of data. I can do batch processing over it. I don't even have to care about time. I can just say, count the number of records. If I do care about time, right now I'm going to say divide my data into fixed windows or sliding windows or tumbling windows or hopping windows or lots of other kinds of windows. And time is a first-class citizen in the Beam model, so this is super easy to do. But of course, those fixed time windows may not be that interesting. I'm usually interested in sort of day-dependent notions of time, such as for one user, what are their sessions? So I'm not interested in hourly data, I'm not interested in daily data, I'm interested in, for each user, when are they active? Now, of course, all of these batch pipelines where you wait, you assume all the data's there at the beginning, you run to completion, those are not necessarily that useful if what you're trying to do is build live, up-to-date systems, so we support streaming. And we support this, the ability to have streaming pipelines that are running fast and keeping up to date, but of course, if data comes in late, like that little red 9 there in that graph, you have to have some way to deal with it. So on top of that, Beam has systems that say, you know, if data comes in late, I can give you both early results and I can give you late results. Sorry, this is Minecraft. You can move it. And late results, and how do you deal with that in a way that lets you really understand pipeline correctness? So what is Apache Beam? Another way of looking at it is that Beam is 3 things. It is that programming model, which I alluded to in the previous couple of slides, lets you ask these questions. But on top of, you know, that's really just a spec. It's really sort of a mathematical concept. It's really a high-level idea. So we have to be able to make it real. So today we have two different SDKs. We have a Java SDK and a Python SDK, where you can write pipelines using these APIs. And then you can take those pipelines that you've written, you can run them on lots of different distributed processing backends. So today there are Beam runners for projects like Apache Flink, Apache Apex, Apache Spark. We have a Google Cloud Dataflow runner. There is a Google Cloud Dataflow runner. You can also run locally on your machine. And we have other runners coming, like GearPump, which is in a feature branch. We have Storm and JStorm, and potentially more. So to really talk about why Beam is unified, I'm going to do so by talking through a pretty simple example, but one that I think shows a lot of power. So let's imagine I'm running some site. And what I want to do is analyze user activity on my site. In a very simple scenario, imagine I have some JSON-encoded data that marks user activities. Maybe I have an attribute called user that says it's Dan. You know, I know what page the user is looking at, and I know what time they're looking. And what I really want out of this is, for each user, how long was the session they were taking, and how active were they? How many pages did they read during that session? So if you imagine, you know, this collection of events on the timeline, event time here on the x-axis is what time the events actually happened, it's pretty easy to look at this with all the data and say, yeah, that's one session. This user was active in this time frame, and maybe they looked at 33 pages. So now, you know, just in the environment of this scenario, you, as the person who owns this application, wants to do two things. One of the things you want to do is you want to have live, up-to-date information on who's using your site. So you're going to throw all these data in, you're going to push all these activities into your Kafka cluster. And what you want is a streaming job that's consuming this stream, that's keeping up with a lag of maybe a few seconds, that can scale to all your user activity, making up numbers, 2 million users over the course of a day. And the key thing you want is you want fresh and correct results, and you want them at low latency. And because this is streaming and you're getting this low latency, it's okay to sort of use a lot of resources. Not a lot, but a reasonable amount of resources that enables you to get that latency. At the same time, I also want to be able to take the same computation, maybe I update it, and I want to go understand what happened on my archival data. Maybe I have data in Hadoop, in files, and here what I really want is I want accurate results, but I don't need them early. I can wait for the job to be done. This is old data. And I really want to be efficient. So maybe instead of using 10 workers for an entire day, I'm going to use a couple hundred workers and only take half an hour. So for the same input, I want the same results. I want everything to be correct. I want to be able to change how much resources I use based on what I'm trying to get out of it. And the question is, what do you have to do to get this kind of results? Now, the industry has a lot of answers for this. One of the first ones, one of the classic ones, is the Lambda architecture. You have some streaming system, but honestly, it's kind of lossy. We don't really understand what its semantics are. When load gets really high, it might drop a lot of data. I don't really trust it. But, you know, I can put some queries in there. I can have it email me or output data or update a table. And I can get my dashboard of fresh results. But since I don't trust it, I'm going to wait, say, till 2 a.m. Then I'm going to run a batch job on MapReduce that takes all the logs from yesterday and analyzes them. Now, why did I wait till 2 a.m.? Well, you know, I know that at midnight I'm not going to have all my data. And by 2 a.m., I probably will. And so I'm going to do my batch analysis. I'll get my correct results for yesterday. And if I'm really worried about data that comes in after 2 a.m., maybe I'll, you know, do sort of a last week analysis later, assuming the data really isn't any more than a week old. And honestly, none of these are very satisfying solutions. So, you know, number one, you're running two different systems, this Lambda architecture and your batch system. Often, they're not even in the same framework. So we have people who tell us, yeah, you know, I really like Spark for batch, but I really want Flink for streaming. So I have these two pipelines that are written in different APIs. I sort of have to keep them in sync. It can be confusing. Sometimes the models don't line up exactly, and I have to do things in different ways, and I have to do a lot of validation to make sure I get the same results on the same data. The other thing that I don't really like about this scenario is that, honestly, the way we deal with completeness is pretty hacky, right? We say, oh, 2 a.m. is good, because I believe data is mostly not more than 2 hours late. It would be nice to be able to understand more deeply how this works. And so the answer that Apache Beam gives you is pretty simple. You write the pipeline once, you change maybe 10 lines of code, I'll explain more about what that means in the next couple slides, and then you supply some command line arguments, and that's all you have to do to achieve these two different scenarios. You can do batch and streaming, you can do Kafka and Hadoop, you can do Flink and Spark, and you can do all of this just, you know, with a few lines of code, command line options. You're not rewriting everything from scratch, you're not maintaining two copies of everything, and you're getting sensible results, correct results even in streaming. So to talk through this, I want to give you a different take on the Beam model, which is what are the primitives we have? And the first couple of these are going to be very familiar to those of you who are sort of very experienced with MapReduce. So, and this is technology that this is terminology that comes from perhaps the old days where you would do things like stick a P on, because hey, it's parallel, and that's not obvious and implicit. But in a distributed system, big data system, you have parallel distributed data, you have a collection of elements, and as I mentioned earlier, time is often very crucial to these concepts. So in Beam, time's a first-class primitive. Elements have timestamps and they're in windows. Now, of course, you can use classic batch where you don't care about time. We just ignore the timestamps and windows. We give them boring defaults. But for most of the exciting stuff, we're actually going to want this information there. Now, how do we get collections of data? Well, that's probably obvious. We have sources, right? So source is some metadata saying, oh, I have my data in a Kafka cluster. I have my data in these files on Hadoop. And then we have readers. And what readers do is pretty cool. They take sources and they read the data, but they try to read the data roughly in order, at least in streaming. They try to read the data roughly in order, and they try to estimate how out of order the data is. And so what they give you is they give you elements with timestamps roughly in order, and they give you a watermark that says how out of order they are. And I'll give you more information about this later as well. So now we have these collections of elements. They're roughly in order. They have timestamps. They have watermarks. What can we do to them? Obviously, we need something that looks like map. That's Pardue. It's a flat map. We need the ability to group by key and combine elements. So we can, take our elements and distribute them in interesting ways and compute the aggregations we need and join things in the way we want. And we also need side inputs, which is like a global view of a collection. It could be completely broadcast. It could be distributed. But this is how you do things like joins. But now, getting back to sort of time, streaming, and triggers, we have windowing operations. So a window is an operation that takes an element in with a timestamp in some window, and it reassigns it to another window, actually zero more windows. We can drop elements when we do windowing. And this might be data dependent. As I mentioned earlier, sessions, one of the most important use cases you have to do data dependent windowing. It can't just be based entirely on time. We also have triggers. Triggers are user flow control. This is how you relate. This is how you say, I want data out at specific intervals. I want to get early estimates of my data so I get freshness. I want to wait till the end. Or even, I want to handle data that comes in late. And I won't talk much about this, but we've also recently added in 2.0, and maybe the release before, state and timers. So this is when you can get cross-element data storage. You can keep memory in, even as you're processing a single sort of collection in a parallel way. And we also have callbacks. So you can do things like, user clicked on a page, I want to set a timer that if I haven't seen the next action from them, go send them a reminder email later. And lots of other things you can do. Enable all kinds of cool and complex workflows that I don't have slides for today, unfortunately. And so, there's a handful of primitives here. I don't know, maybe 7, maybe 8. And with all this, you can implement all these scenarios and more. And the code for this actually is very simple. So I gave you that simple pipeline. And this actually is, I think, the entirety of it. So, although of course there's some dot, dot, dots where we're going to stick in some things later. So we're going to build up a collection of clicks by reading some data and parsing it. We're going to window the data into sessions, specify how we want it output, and then eventually for each key, which is going to be a user, count the number of records in that session. Finally, we're going to format that data and write it out somewhere else. And then we're going to run our pipeline. So this really is the majority of it. This is batch and streaming independent, runner independent, and source independent. Although, of course, the source and sync independent parts are going to be in that blue and green code. So one of the first things I'm going to say is that here's how this API lets you unify sort of batch and streaming in a very simple way. We have these parallel collections, P collections, can be bounded and they can be unbounded. So imagine if the data you're reading from is you're tailing an Apache Kafka topic, you are reading from ActiveMQ, you're watching for new files on Hadoop, and you're tailing your file system, and as they show up, well, again, what is that? That is a live, roughly in order stream of messages, and so these are unbounded collections of data. You represent, say, them with a glob, or a topic name and offsets, or things like that. And so if I want to read from Kafka, okay, the actual code you might write is Kafka.io read from the page views topic. Similarly, I have my archival data in HDFS, I'm not tailing it. I have Kafka offsets, I have it in some cloud-provided storage system. archival data. The cool property here is I can often read it in any order, right? This is bounded data. And so, you know, maybe it's text.io read from some Hadoop glob. This is the entirety of the code that you need to switch between bounded and unbounded, between Hadoop and Kafka, between files and streams. And, you know, really we've unified this in a very simple programming model. So I also mentioned windowing and triggers. So that orange code up there says, I want to window my data into sessions with a gap duration of 3 minutes. So what does that mean, right? I have user activities. When a user is idle for more than 3 minutes, I'm going to call that the end of a session. And the next time they're idle, I'm going to start a new one. So I showed you this earlier. We have all these events here. These are the real user streams when they really happened in that user's time frame. And it's very obvious this is one session from 304 to 305 or 325. The problem is, if you've run any of these systems, you know that this is not how it looks. There's another dimension of time that's really important, which is when does your system actually see the data? When does it process the data? So that's here on the y-axis, that's processing time. That dashed line is the y equals x line. That's the line that says every event comes into my system exactly when it happens. The user clicks on a page, and I see the clickstream exactly when it happens. And of course, you should never expect your events to be on that white line. I've exaggerated the gap maybe, but there's always going to be some gap there. Even more importantly than that, you should not expect events to come into your system in the same order that they happened. So maybe the user is on Wi-Fi, then he gets in the elevator and jumps to 3G, then she goes and takes a train, and so and gets load balanced to a different replica with more load and bigger queues that takes a different path through the internet. So your things are going to come in out of order. And I've represented that by that pink cluster of elements up at the top left. So this is a streaming system, and so that other code in pink is about how I want to get my information out of it. The important thing is, I want to know when the data is done, I want triggering. That's at watermark. And I also want some early information. Say every minute, I want to know what you think the current sessions are. So if a user is currently active and active for a long time, I don't want to find out they're paying attention to my site right now. I want to know, and I don't want to find out only when they finish their hours-long session. I want to know earlier so I can, say, send them an email or offer them a discount. Who knows what? And so how does this look in processing time? So this green bar here is saying, after some fraction of time in real time, what view of the data do I have? So as this bar slides up, this is just like real time executing. So if I get the view of the data I have at this particular timestamp, this is an early result, right? I don't believe I have seen all the data yet. But at this time, it looks like there's one session here, say from 304 to 310. Now later, I get another update that says, okay, with the view I have now at this green time, I've seen the data. There's a big gap in the middle there. This is two sessions. And the first one's from 304 to 310. The second one is from 315 to 320. Only when I've seen all of the data do I realize, oh, this is actually one session. Right, I have to have realized that pink cluster came in. It came in late, but it's the thing that closes that gap and makes this back into one session. And in order to do this, I need to have a watermark that says, okay, this yellow line here is the real heuristic approximation of the real boundary of this surface, the real gap between the yellow line and the white line. And the important thing to realize here is that this is not a constant offset. It's not always 2 hours so that your data at 2 a.m. is ready from midnight. It's often much less than that if things are working well. And then things go bad and it needs to get much bigger. So with this watermark, this is how I get fast, correct, and efficient results. Although, of course, data can come in late, and we'll talk about that later. Okay, so I've grouped my data into sessions. I skip the one line of code, which is, count per key. So for each user, for each session, I want to know how many elements there are. Now I'm formatting for output. This is the dual of reading. Instead of a parse function, I have a format function, and then I write to some sync. And you get the same thing as you had before. You get, I'm writing strings to files, or I'm writing events to Kafka, or things like that. One of the key things with syncs is that you need the ability to have fault-tolerant side effects. And the way you get this is that you can use those sync semantics, and you can exploit them, so you can usually get effectively once delivery. Now, the easiest way to get, exactly once delivery, effectively once delivery, meaning that the effects only happen actually once, is deterministic operations. And that's what a lot of systems require. They say, okay, I can replay everything, and I will get the exact same result on the output. So really, this is okay, I process all my results, they always come in the same order. Nothing in my computation is order dependent. And then I produce a file. The file's already there, I overwrite it. So that if I retry, I get the exact same file. However, that's a pretty limited view of the things you can do here. So you can also do much better with, say, idempotent operations. I'm going to create some files, and if I try creating them again and they're not there, that's fine. Maybe I have something like a database I'm writing to. I can use transactions. I can stick unique IDs in my transactions. And so when I retry results, I can find out, oh, actually, the RPC failed last time I went around that finalized this transaction, but it actually did go through. So I'm just going to, rather than sort of writing the data twice, just drop it on the floor because it's already been committed to the output once. Sometimes you can use within pipeline state, and there are other techniques we can use here. The important thing is there's lots of different ways you can work with this to get effectively once output, which is really end-to-end exactly once output, if the sinks and sources support it. So let's go back to this example pipeline. I told you that we wanted to have a streaming version of this, a batch version of this, maybe running in different environments. Right, the streaming one, I'm getting these speculative outputs. So I had my 2 million users over a day, but because I wanted these early results and user sessions can be pretty long, I actually got maybe 4.7 million results. It took 10 workers to keep up with this all day, so this is 240 worker hours in a day. My batch job, right, I only care about the final output, so I only get those 2.1 million final sessions, but those are the same final sessions you would have seen if you just took the final sessions from the streaming pipeline. And on top of that, I was able to spin up a huge amount of workers, run for a shorter period of time, only 100 worker hours total, so I was more efficient and got my results faster. And the important thing here is that with Apache Beam, the same pipeline works for both. You switch your I/O, you might switch your runners, and that switches between bounded, unbounded, and other things like that. So that's going to conclude the unified part of the model, but let's talk a bit about efficiency. So one of the things here is that Beam is designed from the ground up both to enable runners to do what they want to do and have their own execution characteristics and to be efficient at their discretion. So if you think about how you set up your clusters today, you might say in most clusters you have to pick the number of mappers, the number of machines, the number of replicas. So you say, okay, what I want is I want to read this collection of data and I want to split it 1,000 ways. I've decided 1,000 is the right way to parallelize this. The problem is that the user has to make this decision. And what you see done in practice is, okay, I take my pipeline, I take a small subset of the data, I run the pipeline a couple of times, I decide that I think this is how it scales, and I hope this extrapolates to bigger data. I hope that everything sort of scales linearly, maybe I add some margin for sublinear scaling, and then I parallelize it bigger to bigger data sets. What we really want is the user says, read from this source and let the runner decide. And so we have very simple APIs for this, but they turn out to be really powerful in practice. And I'll show you some real results in a minute that explain that. So, on a bounded source, you can ask it, how big are you? And then you can say, please split into chunks of a given size. And what this looks like is the user says, hey, I want to read, all the files in this Hadoop directory. So the runner says, okay, I see you want to read this data. How big is it? And the source says back, okay, I did a stat operation, and this is 50 terabytes of data. And now the runner can go through and it can say, okay, what is the live information on my cluster right now? How utilized is it? Do I have a lot of nodes or do I have spare nodes? What's the quota? What's the maximum amount I'm allowed to use? What is going to be the bottleneck here? Is it bandwidth? Is it CPU? Is it loading some other cluster? Are there pre-existing reservations? And based on these choices, I can make a dynamic decision that says, I think, for instance, 50 is the right number of tasks to use. So split this up into 1 terabyte chunks. The source, has code that says, okay, 50 terabytes into 1 terabyte chunks. That means I'm going to group this set of files together and that set of files together. I'm not going to send back terabytes of data. I'm going to send back groups of files that represent about 1 terabyte of data each. And then the runner can go process these, assign these files to different tasks. And there's even better stuff we can do, I'll tell you about in a minute. So the important thing is the runner's already made one choice here based on real effects at runtime. The next choice for efficiency is about bundling. So why did the runner choose 1 terabyte as the right unit of parallelization there? So a bundle is a group of elements that are processed and committed together. So imagine you're in a Pardo, you're in your map, your flat map. What this is you have 3 operations here. Start a bundle, process a bunch of elements, and finish a bundle. And in terms of the amount of work you're doing, the amount of work you're committing, this is 1 transaction. So this is kind of like taking one shard in your map and reading all the records in it and writing them all to shuffle, right? That's sort of one parallel task. The important thing is that the user gets no control of bundle size. The runner does. So a streaming runner might say, I'm going to use really small bundles. I'm going to start a bundle, process one element, and close the bundle, right? Really, really small bundles. Maybe I'm going to do more. Maybe I'm going to base it on the availability of data in my queue that all has the same key. So if I pick really small bundles, this is great because it gives me really low latency pipelining. I can start a transaction, I can finish it, and I can pass the results on to the next stage. The problem, of course, as you would expect, is that small bundles mean more transactions. More transactions mean, you know, more overhead of committing. Now, a classic batch runner might say, well, I'm going to use really large bundles. I decided I had 50 workers available to me. I split up your files into 50 chunks, and I'm just going to run the entire file as one bundle. So I do really large bundles. I have very few, much larger commits. I get more efficiency. I get less overhead. But I have these really long synchronous stages where things aren't ready. And of course, there are lots of other runner strategies to strike a different balance. Maybe you operate in the streaming way most of the time, but when your backlog gets big, you switch to batch mode so that you can catch up. Lots and lots of different things you can do here. The other thing, the other knob runners get to play with, which is I think people find interesting, is triggering. So in Veeam, these triggers, this is when you say, it's OK to pass data downstream. The important thing is the user writes the trigger. But it's flow control, it's not instructions. So the user might say, I want updates every minute, but the runner is actually free to ignore that. Triggers are, they unblock flow control, but they don't require you to output. What that means is users can set their triggers for really optimistic scenarios. They can say, when things are streaming well, I want updates every minute, so I can get all my data. But if the pipeline gets backlogged, the runner gets behind, the runner might drop some of those triggers on the floor. They'll keep all the data. They'll just output it later. So they can trade off freshness and efficiency based on what they think is the best scenario for execution time. So in your streaming pipeline, right, the runner's going to optimize for latency and freshness. Small bundles, frequent triggering, as we said. In a batch pipeline, you might drop them entirely on the floor and only output once with the final results. You still get the same data, but you don't get the speculative early results, and the runner gets to decide. Now, that's a bunch of static stuff you can do, some of it dynamic, but one of the really interesting ways to emphasize how you can be efficient is to think about how you handle dynamic behavior. So in any real system, your workload is going to vary. So in a streaming system, you know, users are very diurnal and, in fact, weekly. You know, Amazon sales go through the roof on Black Friday and before Christmas. You know, news articles are when people are drinking their coffee. So you're going to have these varying workloads. And in batch pipelines, you have the same type of thing. Maybe reading from data is really fast and easy to parallelize, but in the middle there, I have some really bottleneck step that's super memory intensive or CPU intensive. I'm training a machine learning model. And different phases of the pipeline require different amounts of resources, have different amounts of parallelism and different costs. And the important thing is that in a lot of systems, you're making fixed decisions. You're saying, I want 10 machines so I can handle my peak workload. Or, you know, that's too expensive, so I'm going to aim for, say, 8 machines and keep up most of the time and slow down a little bit during my peak. Or in batch, you know, I want 80 machines. That's how many tasks I want. And if there's more work to do than that, don't scale up, don't scale down, because that's too hard. And of course, neither one of these is better, right? You don't want to waste all the resources on the left. You don't want to fall behind on the right. Well, you really want something that looks more like this, right? Where I'm sizing my cluster to keep up with my workload, but I'm also scaling down when the load gets smaller. A good analog for this in batch is this notion of stragglers, right? So I broke my initial collection of files into a bunch of different parallel tasks. I thought they were all the same size. They should all run the same. But for a variety of effects, this machine's slower than that one, this network card is bad, you know, that cluster is overloaded, this file has more complex records in it, they're not going to finish at the same time. And so I have these delays, right? I have this batch stage, I can't start the next batch stage until everything's done, but I have these two long tasks that are slowing me down, and all the other machines are just waiting for this to end. So these effects are cumulative in a multi-stage pipeline. And for stragglers, there's lots of standard workarounds you all know. The first one I mentioned, we split our data initially into things that are equal cost, equal byte size, things like that. But that didn't work perfectly. So the next thing I might try is, you know, go ahead and preemptively oversplit. I think I have 50 equal chunks, But, you know, let's go ahead and add a factor of 10 to that, so that if one chunk is much larger than the rest, at least the imbalance won't be too bad. Maybe what I do is I look for slow workers. I hope that it's hardware effects. It's something about that particular worker that's bad, and I kill it and re-execute it. It's work somewhere else. And as long as it wasn't day-dependent issues that are gonna, you know, remain on the new worker, this is a good idea. Or maybe, you know, this preemptively oversplitting in equal size was wrong, and what I do is I go sample extensively. I find the data-dependent variations, and then I split based on that. The problem is all these things are pretty complex. They all have major costs, and none of them actually solves the problem. So when it comes to efficiency, one of the mantras in Beam is that there's really no amount of upfront heuristic tuning you can do, manual or automatically, that's good enough here. None of it is going to be good enough to guarantee good performance. In practice, your system is always going to have something unpredictable happen at runtime. So what we should do is we should design systems that are able to adapt dynamically. We want to be able to get out of a bad situation. And that's much better than having a heuristic, so we hope we don't get into a bad one in the first place. And to show you again a tiny bit of code, here's an API, here's the actual APIs for what we can do in streaming and in batch and bounded and unbounded scenarios to get out of bad situations. So for example, we have APIs that tell you how much work is pending. So if I have some bounded task, like read this collection of files, I can ask the reader, how much work have you done? What fraction of that work has been consumed? Or in a streaming system, I can ask you, what's your backlog? How many records are you behind? How many bytes are you behind? Things like that. And based on these signals, the reader can decide, I want to scale up or I want to scale down. We also have, today, only in the bounded world, work stealing. So I have that long task. I decided that it's based on its completion signals, it's not progressing fast enough. And I want to steal some of its work and give it to someone else. This is kind of like speculative execution, except that in reality, I can also handle sort of, I can save the work you've done so far, and if this is a day-dependent failure, I am not going to waste the work by killing you and then redoing all your expensive work somewhere else. Of course, if we're going to use these things together, we're going to auto-scale, we're going to split work, I don't want to blow your cluster size through the roof, I don't want to use too many resources, so I also have APIs to ask things like, how much parallelism is there actually remaining? Oh, that's a compressed file you're reading from. Oh, you're on the last record of the file. You know, oh, you're in a Kafka topic. You're down the last three records. I don't want to scale up more than a factor of three because if only three records, I can't parallelize more than that anyway. And that's the way we sort of save some of the really bad effects that can happen if you scale poorly. Now, to show you this in action, I have a schematic here. So on the x-axis, we have time. We have green tasks, these yellow tasks, and these beige works. So the idea is the green tasks here are done, and all the yellow tasks are in progress. Now, this line here, this purple line here, is the now line. So this is now, and what happened right now is this green task just finished, and now I have an idle worker. Now I have asked these other four tasks what fraction of their input data they've consumed, and based on the fraction they tell me, which is an approximation, and when they started, I can take that time, I can take their approximation, I can guess, I can extrapolate when I believe they're going to complete. And if I do that, I can add up all the remaining time, all the remaining work seconds. I can say, okay, so I have that much time left, I have five workers. If all the work was distributed perfectly, this second purple line, the average, that is when I would finish. Based on that, I can look now and I can say, it looks like these two beige tasks here, the first and the third one, those are the ones that are going to be the stragglers. Those are the ones that are going to stop me from completing early. In the future, they're going to waste my resources. So what do? Well, I go ahead and execute some work stealing right now. I say, okay, I would like you to split off all the work after the average fraction. So remember, this purple line is when I think I will finish. So I'm going to take that purple line, I'm going to say, that's when that task should finish. And anything after that is a straggler, and I want you to cut it off. What do I do with that work I cut off? I put it back in my pool of work. I give the biggest piece to the worker that's free right now. So now some time passes, right? I gave that largest beige task to this last worker. Meanwhile, this fourth worker completed its task. All the other tasks kept progressing. And at that time, okay, now again, I have another worker that's done, I have a predicted completion time, I have what looks to be another straggler, and I'm going to iterate this, right? I'm going to cut off that little bit of tail here on this last straggler, and give it to another worker. And this way, I can converge to a nice balanced workload, keeping everyone active the whole time. Yeah, question?
Is this logic that the application developer is expected to implement, or is it part of the framework?
There are two components to this logic. One, so for the recording, I guess, the question was, is this logic that the application developer implements or that the framework implements? The answer is that there are two components to it. So the first one is the actual reader itself, the source itself. So if I'm a file reader, I have to have the ability to tell you how done I am and the ability to cut my work off. So for files, that's pretty easy. You know, I have the size of the file. I know I'm currently at offset N. I'm going to, if you ask me to cut off 70% of my work, I'm going to take N in the end and pick 0.7 and cut it off. That's not too complicated. Although there actually is a lot of hidden complexity in doing this correctly. If I have a text file and I say you own bytes 1 to 10 and you own bytes 10 to 20 without knowing where the new lines are, you dang well better emit exactly the right collection of records or we're going to lose data or duplicate data. So we have sort of we have a lot of things to make it easy to implement sources correctly and a lot of things to test them to make sure that these bad scenarios don't happen. The second part of this, the logic of when you actually invoke these APIs, when you decide to split, when you decide what fraction you decide to use, whether you detect, you know, things implemented poorly, how you deal with the approximations that are progress, all of that is sort of runner-specific logic. So you consider that as implementation details of the runner. So, you know, you put the minimal amount of complexity in the source, the basic stuff you need to be able to provide these signals, and then you, again, let runners implement this so that they have the ability to say, for my execution environment with, you know, my logic, that I think this is the best way to operate. Another question.
Another question. So many times you may not be able to speak a data. For example, in a very typical example, let's say some column one, group by column one, so you cannot really split a data because all this sum has to be performed on same machine, right? So there may be, is it would be better that we can see how much machine need to be needed, like typically the way Hadoop or Spark does it, like the biggest screw, like who gonna take the longest time. So you cannot split that guy, but you can combine all the smaller guys so that the number of machines are less. So I was just wondering on that, because how does it solve the situation when you cannot really split your data set?
Yeah, so the question was, if I can summarize a little bit, how we handle the case where we have some unsplittable data, you know, maybe because I'm doing group by key, where one key is much heavier than everyone else. And what I would like to do is optimize my resources in some way so that, you know, if I could detect ahead of time I had one very big key and everything else was small, I might only allocate, say, two machines and have one machine do all the small keys and one machine do all the big keys. Is that a good summary? I mean, so, and I think the answer is dynamic adaptation. So the, you know, we might decide, hey, there are lots of keys we're going to scale up, but we won't be able to kill off some of those workers as we go along. So might it be nicer to sample the data? Quite possibly. There's a lot of unexplored ground here. But if you just wait two slides, I'll show you some real results. And, you know, we can decide the difference between good enough and perfect. And at least better than it is today, and you know, we'll find out. I think going back to the Beam mantra, a lot of the sampling stuff might help. Not the Beam mantra, but a mantra of Beam and efficiency. A lot of this stuff can help, but honestly, dynamically adapting, if you can do it, is just the best way, because you know, there's going to be use cases where that 1% sampling is going to take longer than, you know, scaling up and scaling down some machines, and you know, the clusters were there, they weren't there, et cetera, et cetera. But wait just a second, I'll show you some more slides. Okay, so I think I completed this slide. We've seen how this might work. So how does this work in practice? So the first runner that implemented this was the Dataflow runner, and that's because this is where the code was before it came to Apache. But what I have here is a two-stage batch pipeline. We started off with a bunch of input files to read, and we split those files into equal-sized chunks. However, and there's two stages here, so the first stage has to complete fully before the second stage can start, and we allocated, you know, a static number of machines. And what you see on the y-axis is a couple of things, right? So the y-axis is machines, x-axis is time. You see a little bit of latency here as some of the machines take a little bit longer to start up. But more importantly, what you see is all of this white space here and all the white space there at the end. This is when some machines finish their work, but some other machines are still working, and you can't start the next stage. All these machines are idle until that one straggler task up there finishes. And in this example, we've turned off all the dynamic adaptation I mentioned in the previous slide. But what happens if we turn it on? You get a figure like this one on the right. So you'll see the white space on the left should be the same size. Machines take different amounts of time to start up in different trials. But what you see is, you know, things look a lot more green. There are these vertical white stripes that sort of correspond to lots of similarly sized tasks being completed, new work being created and then assigned. There's little tiny vertical stripes in there. And what you see is the larger bit of vertical white between the two stages is actually much smaller. Right? You still have some stragglers in there, but those are the time constants of, 10 seconds, 30 seconds, 1 minute, which is, maybe the latency it would take to, say, create a new task, split off some work, actually checkpoint that into durable storage and give that work to someone else, open the file and read a small part of it. The more important thing there is on the right, right? After the shuffle, after the blocking stage, right? All of that is savings. All of that is more efficient use in the beginning leads to much earlier completion for this pipeline in this scenario. Now, I also mentioned, and you were asking about auto-scaling, right? So this is actually another real run where what we've done is we've taken an amount of data. We've turned on both dynamic adaptation and auto-scaling. So initially, based on the size of the data, the runner decided that with some predicted throughput, we should allocate 80 workers to this task. That's what you're seeing at the top left, that one vertical bar of workers that all came up at the same time. However, after some time progressed, we decided it was actually a much more expensive job than we thought. We weren't getting the throughput we needed to really perform at the rate we thought. And so we started with, you see these sort of vertical dark lines that are blue, believe me, of those dynamic adaptation rounds. We've said, okay, we want to double our size, but we can't double our size. We only have 80 tasks. The way we do that is we say, okay, you are all going to be stragglers because we want to upscale. So now predicted completion will, say, drop in half. So please cut off the tail of your work in half and give it back to me. Once that's done, we say, ha, I got all these extra tasks, now I can upsize. We allocate new machines, those come online, and this proceeds iteratively throughout the entire execution of the pipeline. So you need dynamic splitting in order to be able to upscale, or you have to oversplit from the get-go, but really it's much more efficient if you allocate the right amounts and adapt dynamically. The key takeaway on this slide is that in this example job, we're able to start from a relatively small cluster, upscale all the way to 1,000 workers. The tasks stay well balanced throughout, right? Things complete at roughly the same time, even all the way on the end. And we didn't have to oversplit initially. This is how these APIs work in parallel. I want to show you one more thing that might be hard to see, so I've highlighted it, which is these large horizontal stripes. There's, 1, 2, 3, 4 big ones and some small ones. All of those are long-running tasks that failed for some reason. So, three of those initial 80 tasks ran for almost 80% of the job and then died. And all that work was lost because we had large bundles. We had, therefore we had large transactions. And all that work was uncommitted so far. So they died and we had to retry it. The important thing is we didn't get stragglers because of this, right? I had this long task. And if I were to retry it as it was in its original form, it would be off the slide to the right. But once I retried it, it was immediately recognized to be the straggler. It was immediately cut up into a bunch of pieces and given to these other workers down here. And so we're able to proceed in a balanced way, even in the presence of failures.
So the workers were added. Did the frequency of worker additions and the number of workers added changes all the way down?
Yeah, I mean, all of this is runner-dependent logic. So, how we chose 80 initially is based on, say, size of files and estimated throughput, how we upscale. I don't even know the control logic for this. But this is, runner-specific logic of what I think the stragglers are, what quota you might have. We had set 1,000 as a hard cap for this job. So it looks like it's roughly doubling. And then at the end here, you can't double anymore because you can't go past 1,000. But I don't know the exact details, actually.
And the input for this test, the actual source for in the validation?
I believe it was one very large file.
Okay.
With some amount of records being processed.
Thanks.
When you cut a spread like this, and it allows you not to go beyond the slide, do you lose the beginning of the work that you've done?
No. So the question was, do you lose the beginning of the work if you have the straggler? So no. So right, this task says, I own, let's say, this large byte range of this file. All that work has been processed, but it hasn't been committed yet. So when that work is uncommitted, the runner basically says, okay, I'm going to assume none of that work was done. And I'm going to create a new task, which is exactly the same amount of work, starting from the beginning. And then, but you know, rather than running it as one task, we're still going to start cutting off the ends and giving them to someone else in a consistent way, though, where all the records are still going to be there. The union of the two parts is still equal to the whole. And so that also gets back to what I said earlier about sort of idempotence exactly once. It's just that if this task had some side effects, it has to be the case that retrying this task still results in the same external state.
From 80 workers to 1,000 workers, it's a big increase. Is there a concept of quota?
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, again, this is all runner specific, but in all runners, I believe, you have machine limits, you have resource limits, you have quotas. You can limit jobs, you can have sort of user quotas, all kinds of things like that. There's nothing at all stopping there from quotas. And this is another one of those things that is, the user's quota is often execution environment runner dependent.
When you say runner specific, are you referring to Beam application adapters, the YSA Spark or Flink or a different actual execution engine?
So the question was, what does runner specific mean? Yeah, so a Beam runner is the translation layer between a Beam pipeline, which is independent of any of these things, and the actual execution engine, right? So yes, Spark, Flink, Apex, it might be Yarn, right? I mean, the runner is kind of everything involved in execution. So it might be your AWS credentials and quotas. It might be in conjunction with your Yarn cluster manager, in conjunction with, I don't know, Zookeeper telling you what to do over here, in conjunction with how big your Kafka cluster is that you're reading from. There's sort of, it's, but in the scenario we're talking about here, it's usually meaning, yes, the instances of Apex, Spark, and Flink, and Dataflow that you're running. And where that logic lives exactly is going to depend on implementation. It might be sort of Flink specific, or if they all use Yarn as a common substrate, it might be Yarn based, Mesos based, etc.
What about scaling down and preemption?
So yes, scaling down and preemption. Okay, so scaling down, I mean, it's handled exactly the same way. This example doesn't show it, but you know, if we have one large key that's taking a long time and there is no more parallelism, I alluded to that sort of parallelism API earlier, we might just shut all these workers down and free the resources and give them back to the pool. So both in batch and streaming on Dataflow, we do this, you know, very naturally. And this is where it gets important to implement those signals to say, you know, if you can give me a good estimate of parallelism, that'll help me both scale up and scale down. Now you asked about preemption. So you're talking about specifically like sort of killing ongoing tasks, or?
Or just reducing the amount of parallel work based on another job that you need to run.
Yeah, so let's say you get preempted, there's lots of things you can do here. You can imagine that what this might do is this says, okay, in 3 minutes, I'm going to have many fewer resources. So I'm suddenly going to decide all the resources I'm going to kill need to stop working immediately. And you can use those same dynamic adaptation APIs saying, please split off the tail of your work, to translate that as please stop working right now, but actually commit what you have. So you have the ability to scale up and down in those scenarios as you need to free up resources for some other use.
The definition of mature might be subjective, but which runners would you say are mature implementations of rebalancing and auto-scaling?
Today, there is only one runner with a mature implementation. The direct runner has the ability to exercise it for testing, and we're working on integrating this. You know, I think both Spark and Flink in the last couple releases have started adding the ability to upscale and downscale and streaming, and we'd like to integrate that with that as well.
Okay. Thank you.
The question was about which runners have mature implementations of this. All right, so thanks for all the questions. I'm actually getting really close to time, so I'm going to wrap up. So if you take away nothing else, the next talk in Beam is about the green word now, portability. So I gave you the insights of portability, right? I showed you this pipeline. I alluded to, you know, a few code changes that make this work and be runnable between batch and streaming on lots of different runners. And so that completes this picture. But if you take away nothing else from this talk, remember this. Beam is unified, it's efficient, and it's portable. And it's a programming model that's designed to connect all these things together. And all my examples were in Java, because that's the thing I've been growing up with. But there actually is a Python SDK, integrates with lots of great Python libraries. Today, it runs on your local machine and in Dataflow, and we're working on building a framework that would actually let Python programs run, you know, natively on Spark and Flink and Apex, independent of what language those execution environments are written in. So get involved. I already mentioned there's lots of talks at this conference, Birds of Feather tonight, Hacking Day tomorrow. We also, you know, but basically there's lots of ways to use this. If you have your own data, come try Beam out. If you are excited about a particular storage messaging system, write a connector. We've talked a lot about what those connectors look like today. There's also a lot of exciting work on big data APIs, so new SDKs, but also new DSLs and libraries. There is a whole bunch of exciting work on, you know, CalSite integration, on, you know, there's a Shio, which is a Scala interface to write programs against the Beam SDKs. And of course, we want more runners. So as I mentioned, we have Apex, Apache Apex, Flink, Spark, GearPump, Dataflow today. We have Storm in development. There's lots of other ideas. And you know, this is really intended to integrate everything. So the more things that integrate, the better. Again, three more talks in this room, lots of other opportunities. But that concludes my talk. Here's a couple of resources to learn more. And thanks for listening.